This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Mary Gordon, author of Final Payments, The Company of Women, and Men and Angels. She's one of the few serious novelists whose work has recently made it to the bestseller list. Religion figures in all of Mary Gordon's novels. She had a traditional Catholic upbringing and seriously entertained the idea of becoming a nun. Now she has serious differences with the church, but she still thinks of herself as having been shaped by Catholicism. Mary Gordon lives with her husband and two children in upstate New York. In her new novel, Men and Angels, the main character, Anne, is torn between devotion to her family and to her work. Anne is an art historian researching the life of an early 20th century American woman painter. To free time for her research while her husband is on sabbatical in France, she hires a live-in babysitter who secretly believes she has been chosen to carry out God's will. She is, in fact, mad. Her presence leads to tragedy in the house. Men and Angels is published by Random House. I wanted to know about religion in Mary Gordon's life. I asked her why, as a child, she wanted to become a nun.
I thought about becoming a nun until I became pubescent, and then I think that I thought that giving up the love of men was too great a price for the total love of God. So very quickly, although my whole young childhood had been shaped by fantasies of myself as a nun, when I got my first crush on a boy, I gave it up instantly and never went back.
Did you feel like you'd lost something when you did that?
I don't think so, because I think I always had the other vision of myself as a writer, which was an alternate romance. And so I could substitute the religion of art for the religion of religion, so to speak. So that even in my fantasy life, I thought I'd be a nun who wrote poetry. I then sort of merely excised the nun part from it and thought I would devote myself to the altar of mere poetry.
What did you imagine when you saw yourself as a nun? What kind of life did you see?
I imagined a life of beauty and austerity and absoluteness. I remember being a young child and going to a convent with my parents and seeing a nun in a blue habit, a sort of sky blue habit, which was anomalous because most habits were black, and seeing her praying in a chapel with the light coming on her, striking this very vivid colored blue veil. And I thought, well, this is what I want for myself. And although at the time I couldn't have named that as an experience of the perception of beauty, it was that kind of beauty that seemed so clear and so light-filled and so hard-edged. I think that was what attracted me to the experience.
It's funny that you keep talking about religion in terms of aesthetics and not in terms of God.
Well, I think that the religious experience is closest to the aesthetic experience of any other. It's certainly, I think, much closer to the aesthetic experience than to the ethical experience, because I think that we have absolutely no evidence that religious people are more ethical than anybody else. Possibly we have evidence to the contrary. But I think that the experience of religion comes closest to the perception of beauty.
Did you go through a period of rebelling against the church?
Oh, yes. I think the minute I became a teenager and primarily saw the conflicts between religion and sexuality, my rebellion began. I think that's terribly unfortunate about the experience of Catholicism, particularly in America. American Catholicism, in that it is really Irish Catholicism, is sexually obsessed, so that it begins to seem for people who want to discover their sexuality that they have to choose either a sexual life or a religious life. And I think that's terribly unfortunate.
When you left the church, in part because of finding like your own sexuality, did you disavow your affiliation, your past affiliation with the church? And were you embarrassed to tell friends that you had been religious and had considered becoming a nun?
What I did was that I made a shtick out of it. And because practically everybody, all my friends, were Jewish, it was like saying that you were Burmese or something to say that you were a Catholic. It was so exotic to them. And, you know, you could tell all your stories about patent leather shoes and, you know, buying pagan babies for a dollar. I mean, that was something which you did. There was an organization called the Holy Childhood, and they would say, you can buy a pagan baby for $5. What it meant was that you got to name this child when it was baptized. So there are all these children in, you know, Thailand who were named Kimberly. No, it would never be Kimberly. It would have to be a saint. It would always be Teresa was a big name that we all chose. So all this sort of detail was, to secular friends or intellectual friends, hilariously funny. That was the way that I dealt with it, that it became a kind of routine that I did. All the time acknowledging my separateness from what I had come from.
Did you ever just think of going back, and do you consider yourself a Catholic now?
Well, yes, I do consider myself a Catholic, but the kind of Catholic I am may be that I belong to a church which exists only in my mind and the minds of like-minded people. I do consider myself a Catholic, but I am consistently appalled by the positions of the official church, particularly in relation to women, so that I don't know how much the Catholic Church considers me one of them. I certainly consider myself very much a part of the Catholic Church, very formed by it, and very importantly belonging to it.
Religious issues have, I think, always entered your novels, and it's interesting that the religious character in your new novel is someone who is, in fact, mad. It's not the kind of rational person at the center of the book, wrestling with certain religious and secular dilemmas. She sees herself as being the chosen of God. Do you see her as being mad?
Yes, absolutely mad. And I've been slightly amused by the fact that a certain number of reviewers have merely responded to her as a religious fanatic and not as quite the madwoman that I meant her to be. And I feel that the perception behind that is a prejudice that anyone who is religious is probably slightly mad anyway. And Laura is just sort of the right wing of the religious sensibility. I meant her to be a very damaged person. I meant her entire religious life to be an expression of the damage that was really the center of her personality.
So you must have given a lot of thought to what kind of person or what kind of problems lead to the kind of madness in religious imagery and religious terms that she has. Have you done research into that or just given it personal thought?
I seem to have just given it thought and observed people whom I had encountered who were like this, and observed the growing and I think quite frightening tendency around us for people to really embrace fundamentalism out of, I think, a kind of terror and hunger. And I felt that this young woman that I was describing was a terrified and a starving soul. And I was very interested in that phenomenon of really going to religion for a sort of sustenance, which was essentially not religious. Going to religion to be fed because it seemed to offer a sort of certainty or a sort of romance or a sort of drama or a sort of strength. But essentially going to religion because one was empty of anything else.
In your previous novels, there were many conflicts between the religious and the secular life. And one of the central conflicts in your new book is between a woman's devotion to her family and her devotion to her work. Were you experiencing that kind of conflict yourself when you were writing this book?
I haven't really experienced the conflict myself, and that's because I have a very anomalous position, and I'm very lucky. I have work that I love, which I feel consumes me, and which I can devote myself to. And I have a wonderful husband, and I have two children. I happen to be a writer, so I can make my own hours. I happen to have an academic husband whose schedule is flexible. And I happen to be able to afford a babysitter for half the day. And so I think that I've been spared a lot of the wrenching conflict which absorbs a lot of the psychic energy of most of the women that I know. There seems to be a very cruel choice imposed upon women, that they feel they have to either choose a family or work or tear themselves in half trying to be the perfect mother and the perfect achiever, to the point where they must be exhausted and feel utterly futile and failed at whatever they do. And I think it is the most difficult issue facing women today.
Your main character, at a time when her husband's leaving to France and she was going to go with the two children to France with him, decides instead to stay at their home in America because she's just been offered a position to write an important essay on an early 20th century woman painter, and she doesn't want to pass up this opportunity. So with her husband gone, she becomes for a year a single parent of two with a live-in babysitter. Because of that choice that she's made, some very terrible things happen in the house through the babysitter who she takes in, who's the religious fanatic who is mad. Do you think that that's a fear that a lot of women have, that if they give up a certain amount of family investment so that they could have that professional interest, that obsession with their work as well, that they're opening up the door for horrible things to happen to the people who depend on them for love and attention?
Yes, I think that it's a terror that haunts every mother. And I certainly didn't mean to reinforce that terror. One review accused me almost of trying to set up a boogeyman for working mothers. And I certainly didn't intend to do that. I meant to say that we are all terribly vulnerable, that to be a mother puts you and your children into terribly vulnerable positions simply by living life. And I guess what I wanted to say is that there is no protection from it. With the best intentions in the world, tragedy can strike. And I think the only real mistake is assuming that somehow if you are careful enough, if you watch the children closely enough, if you do exactly the right things, you'll be able to protect them from horror. And you never can, and you simply have to live with that.
You know, there's a passage about that, about your children being exposed to horror, that I'd like you to read. And it's at the very end of the book. And my guest is novelist Mary Gordon, and she's going to read a passage now of her new book, Men and Angels.
The children would grow up knowing life was terrible and they were never safe. They would grow up like the children of the poor. Not for them the images and stories of small animals and houses decorated with light colors, of adventures where the dangers would be vanquished and the bleeding hero make his way back home. The children of the poor knew something. You could see it in their faces, on the city streets, in grainy pictures in the papers, in news footage of the dusty dead towns. And they were waiting, the children of the poor. It was the thing that they were good at, waiting, and they would not be surprised. Yet this early news of sorrow did not always bring them wisdom. It could bring despair, the heart's death, the empty hopelessness of the young killer who knows anything might happen, and so anything is possible to do. Children should not know violence, she thought. When they did, they stopped being children. Childhood was a middle-class invention, a luxury the poor knew better than to try to hold too long. But she had had a childhood, a false spring, an overlasting summer. And Michael, too, for all that he had suffered, knew it. They had had it in mind for their children. They had shaped their lives to give it to the two that they had brought into the world. Now the children had lost their patrimony, lost the blessing of their parents' house, the confidence, the safety they could wear into the world like a gold ring, a sign. What would they wear now into the world? What would replace what they had lost? Would kindness replace safety like a richer cloak? Or would they wear the bloody skins of the impossible to think of poor? Or would they go half naked like the freezing Lear with no fate for them but an animal's bad luck?
How protected were you as a child?
Oh, I mean, I was tremendously protected. It was a different world. I was very protected, but then my father died when I was seven. So sorrow entered my life, and all the good intentions of my parents really didn't matter. because the most terrible thing that could have happened to me happened, because my father was really the beloved parent, and he was taken away, and they couldn't have done anything to protect me from that. So all their desires to protect me in the end didn't really protect me.
There's a section I'd like to ask you to read about parental love, specifically mother love, and its intensity and its difference from other forms of love. It's on page 17, if you'd you'd read that section for us. This is again from Mary Gordon's new novel, Men and Angels.
No one had told her what it would be like, the way she loved her children. What a thing of the body it was, as physically rooted as sexual desire, but without its edge of danger. The urge to touch one's child, she often thought, was like and wasn't like the hunger that one felt to touch a lover. It lacked suspense and greed and the component parts of insecurity and vanity that made so trying the beloved's near approach. Once the children were in the house, the air became more vivid and more heated. Every object in the house grew more alive. How I love you, she always wanted to say, and you can never know it. I would die for you without a thought. You have given to my life its sheerest, its profoundest pleasure. But she could never say that. Instead, she would say, how was school? Was lunch all right? Did you have your math test?
Did you have children when you wrote that? Because part of it is about how you can't possibly understand. No one had prepared her for this feeling that she had toward her children. I mean, did you know that firsthand when you wrote that?
No, I did. I had one child when I wrote that. Actually, it's interesting. I wrote that. I had a miscarriage between my two children. And I wrote that passage in a hospital bed. I was trying to keep the baby. And I had to lie completely still for 10 days. I, in the end, lost it. But I missed my daughter so terribly. I'd never been separated from her that long. And I wrote that lying in a hospital bed, unable really to move, trying to save another child whom, in the end, I lost.
Oh, gee, and it's a really beautiful passage. Do you feel that same intensity, that same kind of intensity of feeling now as a mother?
Absolutely. I'm just, you know, I'm obsessed with them, and I think about them all the time. I haven't seen my son now, who's 15 months old. I haven't seen him for 2 days. And I could fly to the train to get back just to hold him. You know, the physical fact of him and of his flesh is just enchanting to me. I love being in his presence. And my older daughter, too, although I saw her yesterday, so my missing her is somewhat less acute. But I'm longing to see them. I can hardly bear that I haven't seen them in so many hours. It's almost physically painful to me. See, I really want to hold them.
So you think the quality of a love of a mother for her children is kind of different than the quality of other loves, that there's some different quality about it?
Yes, as I say, it's more like sexual love than any other kind of love, except it's more responsible and it goes on longer. I've never been able to, I mean, I certainly never was able to sustain that kind of passionate ardor for a man for 4.5 years the way I have for my daughter. And the kind of obsession I've never been able to sustain, much as I love my husband. If I'm separated from him for 2 days, you know, I miss him, but not the way I miss these babies. And so it's a very odd kind of love made up of very practical components and very sensual components and very spiritual components. It's a mixture of control and utter lack of control. It's very strange.
Do you think that, since you write about a mother with two children who's also trying to work in your book, that people have interpreted that as being you?
Yes, I'm amused and irritated by the way in which, because I've written about motherhood, both in this book and in a piece I wrote for The Times, I feel like I've begun to take on a symbolical presence for people that I don't think that many serious writers have written about motherhood. And I think because of that, particularly women, but men also, have focused a lot of their fantasies, a lot of their resentments or romances about motherhood onto me. On the one hand, I have been accused of being too much the ideological feminist. On the other hand, I've been accused of being too sentimental about motherhood and not taking the proper feminist line. And as I said, I'm accused of being anti-babysitter. And then people have come up to me expecting me to mother them in an odd and a new way that I find very puzzling. And I think it could never happen to a male writer. I mean, even if a male writer wrote about fatherhood, people's needs for father is not quite so focused or so clear as their obsession. I mean, motherhood seems to be an obsessive topic. And yet it hasn't been treated in literature very much because it hasn't really been considered respectable.
The couple in your novel tries to create a kind of family that is the family they both wished they had grown up in when they were young. There's a passage I'd like you to read about that, about the family that they've created for themselves. It's on page 20 or 21. This is, again, another passage from Mary Gordon's new novel, Men and Angels.
Only recently, Anne had realized that her mother must have been depressed for years. Only depression could account for her thorough failure, the spiritless performance of a woman of spirit, the gross blunderings of a woman whose whole talent was for fineness, for distinction. She thought of the elaborate meals her mother had planned and burned, the dresses she had made and then ruined with her iron, the wallpapers that cried out horribly against the brocade chairs. Then it had changed. She had gone back to school, had got her degree. It was too late for Anne. She was in college by then. Anne thought of her mother's wedding picture, Susan Hollowell, Mount Holyoke class of 41, looking more the honor student than the bride, holding her bouquet over her head like a basketball or a torch. She was laughing, and one could see the joke. This dashing girl was going to pretend to settle down. How had that girl turned into the mother Anne remembered, covering her ears and begging her children not to fight, crying when her younger daughter refused for the 50th time to drink her milk? Seeing her mother like this, it had early become clear to Anne that she had to be the mother of the house. This was the secret of her bond with Michael. They had both been, as children, mothers, both involved in the conspiracy at the center of the lives of children of deficient parents, the conspiracy to keep from the world this shame, this failure, above all to make it appear that the life inside the sorrowing house was the same as any other. They had married early because they wanted to reinvent domestic life. It was a romance dear to both of them. They could never understand, really, their friends who wanted to live in purposefully ugly places, bare mattresses on the floor, empty tuna cans for ashtrays, posters stuck to the wall with thumbtacks half falling down. For them, a vase of living flowers was a miracle. A loaf of bread they'd made together was a precious vessel, holding all they'd wanted for their lives. It was only after they'd done it all, bought the house, had the babies, that they realized that others who'd done what they had done thought they were reinventing domestic life. But by that time, it was no longer an invention. It was simply their life.
Do you know a lot of people who have tried to reinvent a family life for themselves, either the one they wanted or one opposite from the one they grew up in?
Yes, I think that we probably all invent domestic life in terms of our parents, either in opposition to them or in imitation of them. And there's an odd kind of yuppie romanticism, I think, that exists now, which assumes that if you make homemade bread and homemade pasta, that you can somehow, bring back the 50s or cancel out all the jangling, unpleasant reality of the present. And I find it an odd sort of romance because these are people who are achieving in the outside world, and yet they seem to be operating under the rubric of a domesticity which is not really possible for them because they don't have the heart of it and don't really want the heart of it, and yet they want some sort of odd appurtenances of it in some way that has no center.
I know you consider yourself a feminist. How are you introduced to feminism?
I went to Barnard, which was a women's college, and I was there in the late 60s and early 70s, and it was absolutely in the air, and it was utterly exciting. One suddenly felt that one could do anything, that there was nothing one couldn't do because one was a woman. And I remember reading The Golden Notebook in 1969 and just thinking, gee, you know, other people have had these thoughts about men. Other people have had these thoughts about work. And I can do anything in the world. I thought it was such an exciting time. There was such a sense of promise in the air and such a sense of possibility for a new humanity. And it was perfectly wonderful. And I feel that it's been, I feel so fortunate that when I was still quite a young woman, I was able to be influenced by that wonderful first wave of feminism.
Were you ever criticized for writing about women's lives when you were in school? Were you ever encouraged to travel abroad or hitchhike cross country so that you'd have a real theme
Absolutely.
Of importance?
Absolutely. There was such a prejudice against female experience as being trivial or, you know, if I could only, the only way... Interestingly enough, the only way that that female experience was considered interesting was if it abutted onto violence. So that if something horrible had been done to a woman, that was okay to write about. But it was not okay to write about ordinary domestic life. That was considered soft-edged and sloppy and maudlin and sentimental. And I think that was, in some ways, the most difficult thing for a woman writer to unlearn. Now, this didn't happen to me in college because I went to a women's college and had women professors. But once I went into a graduate writing program, the prejudice was very definitely in favor of obscuring female experience or distancing oneself from it or trying to get another experience that was not female in its nature.
How did you resist that?
I resisted it. A group of us in graduate school realized, and again, it was 1971-72, beginning of the women's movement, we realized that this was being done to us. We didn't like it, and we got together every week and met and read each other's work and sort of realized that if we were going to get a degree, we had to listen to these men. But the really meaningful criticism was going to come from each other. And so we supported each other, and I think we were smart enough and tough enough just to say, they're wrong.
Novelist Mary Gordon, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Mary Gordon is the author of Final Payments, The Company of Women, and Men and Angels, which is her latest novel. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical directors for this edition were Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Maeve McGoran. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.